Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is writer Glenn Frankel, who was a longtime journalist for the Washington Post, winning a Pulitzer Prize in 1989. But in recent years, he's enjoyed a second career, writing about classic American films in a series of books. His last two books have been on the seminal westerns High Noon and The Searchers. But his latest book documents a very different Wild West, so to speak, the world of male hustlers and the grittiness of New York City's Times Square in the late 1960s is the backdrop of the Academy Award-winning film Midnight Cowboy. The film, the only X-rated film to win the Best Picture Oscar, ushered in a whole era of gritty urban dramas during the 1970s with its frank subject matter, homosexuality, prostitution, sexual assault, set in New York City at a time when the city itself seemed to be decaying. Filming took place during a sanitation strike. But John Schlesinger's film, the source material from novelist James Herlihy, adapted by former blacklisted writer Bruno Salt, and amazing performances by Dustin Hoffman and John Voight, attracted a new audience looking for a different style of filmmaking and storytelling. Frankel recounts the story of the film and all of the backstories of the principles and the context surrounding the film in Shooting Midnight Cowboy: Art, Sex, Loneliness, Liberation, and the Making of a Dark Classic. It's published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. He'll be participating in a Magic City Books virtual event this Thursday evening at 7 o'clock. Visit magiccitybooks.com for details. Glenn Frankel joins us again on Studio Tulsa. Glenn Frankel, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich.
This is the third book that you've done on film classics, High Noon, The Searchers, and now Midnight Cowboy. Now, I'm not sure where Midnight Cowboy fits in this over of these sort of iconic films. It was a groundbreaking film, but it's one that's very rarely seen these days, or is it?
You know, that's interesting, Rich, because I sort of thought the same thing until I set out to start doing the book and told people about it, and I got very warm reactions. People have seen this movie. It's still being shown. It's in the AFI, the American Film Institute's top 40 or so. I was interested because, as you point out, I'd done these other two iconic westerns, which dated back to the 50s, and I wanted to move a little forward in time. I was interested in more adult themes. What my books try to do is combine telling the story of the making of a great movie and the era, the historical era it was made in or it reflects. And Midnight Cowboy was filmed mostly in 1968, came out in 69. That was a turbulent time in American history, and it was just rich terrain. So, it turned out to be a wonderful project for me. But yes, it's different than the other two, and I think in some ways that were really interesting.
Was the factor that attracted you the fact that you'd done these two Western books, and now here is a man from the West who comes in to be a hustler in Times Square, or what exactly was that attracted you to this particular film?
Well, it's a cowboy trilogy, only if you really want to stretch it. but I, again, the adult themes, the rich terrain, it was a challenge, and it gave me an opportunity to use some of the same processes I developed for the other two books, but for a more modern movie. What I also, I didn't realize till I started on it, is even though the movie's 50 years old, a lot of the folks who were involved in making it are still around, and you can talk to a lot of them, or certainly talk to people, in the case of some of the ones who have passed away, talk to people who were very close to them, and that just gave it more of an immediate feel. Also, I had lived in New York. I went to college in New York from 1967 to 71, so I have my own impressions of the city at that time, this incredibly complex place where young people come to sort of find themselves, including me back in the day. And so it had a personal connection as well. A lot of reasons. I mean, books, you've got to really believe in a book and believe in the process in order to undertake it. And I felt very good about this one.
Of course, the film is, becomes the only film with an X rating ever to win Best Picture at the Academy Awards. And of course, fast forward 10 years ago, it would have been a very hard R. But in 1968 and 1969, you have to remember, this film probably wouldn't have been filmed 4 or 5 years previously.
That's absolutely right. And that was another factor for me. It comes along at a point where the Hollywood studio system is in deep trouble. You know, ticket sales are down. The older audiences are fading. Studios are trying to attract a younger audience, but the old genres, the Western, which is my favorite, and I'm sad to say, movie musicals, biblical epics, those things just weren't bringing younger people into the box office, and Hollywood was changing. And the change in the censorship system was part of that. Until 67, 68, they had something called the Production Code, which was a tough little in-house system among the studios themselves. Under that code, you couldn't even show, a married couple in bed together, let alone having sex. You know, Hollywood knew they needed to reach younger audiences, wanted to be able to do more adult themes, to do more complicated movies or movies that might attract young people. And so they put in the rating system, which we still have today. Midnight Cowboy was one of the first movies rated, and it was rated X. And so that became an important part of what I was writing about. I mean, the movie breaks a lot of barriers, if you will, especially when it comes to adult themes, and the X rating reflected that.
Did the X rating actually attract people to the cinema, or did it drive people away?
It was a mixed bag in that there were a lot of newspapers, say, that wouldn't advertise X-rated films, and a lot of movie houses that wouldn't show them. But at the same time, in reaching out to younger audiences, United Artists, the company that backed the movie, had a very clever marketing campaign that used the X rating as a tool. One of the slogans was, "Everything you've heard about Midnight Cowboy is true." And so the X rating did become, people in college or people in their 20s, it was a drawing card, and they took full advantage of it.
Now, this starred John Voight and Dustin Hoffman. And, of course, Dustin Hoffman was involved with a film just a couple years previous, The Graduate, which literally had flipped Hollywood on its head. It was all of a sudden, it was a film made about young people, which Hollywood really wasn't doing at that time. How did this film fit in his line of attracting that young audience to Midnight Cowboy?
Well, that's a very important point. I mean, Hoffman and The Graduate was a breakthrough movie. It was one of the first real generation gap movies, and it took the point of view of this young man, Benjamin Braddock, who's just out of college. And it was Hoffman's breakthrough film. It made him not just a movie star, but a sort of counterculture icon. For one thing, there is 5'6" Dustin Hoffman, dark-haired, fairly large nose, very ethnic looking, not Robert Redford, not Cary Grant, a different kind of movie star. And Hoffman was a product of the New York stage world, theater world, and not a terribly successful product. I mean, he was very, very good as a character actor, but it was hard for him to get parts. And he slowly works his way up through there. He had no ambitions to be a star in Hollywood, or at least no aspirations. He didn't think that was possible, and yet here he was after The Graduate, a kind of celebrity all of a sudden. But he was a character actor. He'd worked on his art for so long, he wanted to do parts that showed his skills. And so he was very interested in Midnight Cowboy from the start. There are two main characters in the movie. There is the Midnight Cowboy himself, a guy named Joe Buck, who comes from Texas, a young man, handsome young guy, who comes to New York, thinking he's going to become a male hustler and servicing middle-aged affluent women. Along the way, he finds out that business plan doesn't work very well. And a number of, I would say, what I would call New York-style predators take advantage of this guy and slowly strip him of his money, various characters in various, sometimes very humorous scenes in the movie. And Hoffman plays Ratso Rizzo, this abled, homeless, shabby con man from the Bronx. And he at first takes Joe Buck's money also, but eventually these two begin to form a sort of wary friendship because they're lonely guys, they're on the street, and they need somebody to protect them. And Hoffman really thought this was a part where he could show the other side, if you will, of his skills. And he is important in the success of the movie because he was so popular all of a sudden. Everybody recognizes him. He becomes the Jewish Cary Grant, is the way one person described him. Time magazine even called him the fifth Beatle. All that's kind of silly looking back on it, but Hoffman filled a new need in movies, And as I say, I think he's a very important part of Midnight Cowboy's success.
So how did this film come about? Let's start with the man who wrote the script, and that is James Leo Herlihy. Tell us a little bit about him. I mean, he has this really interesting backstory that you spend quite a bit of time on. He was befriended by Aeneas Nin. He's going back and forth between New York and Key West. He's befriending Tennessee Williams. He's sort of in this literary group that's quite impressive, but we don't know his name the way we know those other names.
No, James Leo Herlihy is a more or less sadly forgotten figure. He's a young guy, serves in the Navy at the end of the war. He's from Detroit, working class guy, barely made it through high school, wants to be a writer. Handsome guy, extremely handsome guy. So he also takes acting lessons out at the Pasadena Playhouse, which incidentally Dustin Hoffman comes to about 5 years later. But at any rate, Herlihy comes to New York in the early 50s, gets involved in the sort of gay artist community. He's a gay man himself. As you point out, he had formed a friendship with Aeneas Nin, who eventually becomes the very famous erotic diary writer. But in the 40s and 50s, she's struggling. It's hard for a woman to get any traction in the literary world. But she recognizes his talent. I think she's attracted to him as well, even though he's gay. And she helps him get a footing in New York. In the 50s, he has a play on Broadway for a while. He writes his first novel, and it is made into a movie. You know, he's doing well. I had hoped Jim Herlihy would take me around Times Square, you know, in his diaries and his papers. Jim died in 1993, but I was hoping for him to be my guide to New York in that very lively era. But he's a very discreet guy. But when you read Midnight Cowboy, which is by far his greatest novel, written and published in 1965, you see that he's very knowledgeable about the life of Times Square and about hustling and these kinds of things. He puts a lot of himself in this character, Joe Buck, this lonely Texas guy who comes to New York. You know, young people come to New York from all over the world, really, looking to find themselves, looking to use their talent, testing themselves. And Jim Herlihy was one of those guys, and he makes Joe Buck, his character, one of those guys as well. So Jim, the novel doesn't do all that much in 1965, but a guy named John Schlesinger, a British film director, who's been very successful in the UK and now wants to make his first American movie. John comes across this book, really likes it, thinks the story he tells about coming to New York is one that he can identify with and that he finds. And so he takes this little obscure novel, convinces United Artists, a sort of independent studio, to give him a minimal budget to make it, and they're off and running.
Now, Schlesinger is the second person in this that we learn about. He had a great first film. The second film was, I guess, fairly dreadful. I've never seen it, but it was apparently nothing happens in the film, and critics really did not like it. So this was sort of the comeback for Schlesinger, at least for American audiences, right?
Well, that's right. He'd had some real success in the UK with his first three movies, actually. These are little black and white movies made in the north of England. His big hit, though, is the third movie. It's called Darling. It's Julie Christie's first starring role, and it is a sort of a satire takedown of swinging London in the 60s. And she is so good in it, and he's so good at directing her. She wins the Academy Award for Best Actress in 1966 for really what's her first starring role. So Schlesinger is kind of a hot thing. He makes Far From the Madding Crowd, this big, you know, Panavision movie that flops. But still, there are people in the States who want to work with him. These British actors and directors always end up coming to the U.S. sooner or later because that's where the money is and bigger ambitions. And John Schlesinger comes, but he wants to make this quirky movie about a hustler in Times Square. And, you know, the studios like MGM, they're not interested in that kind of thing. But United Artists, this smaller film company, which likes to take chances, which had been very successful with things like The Beatles, A Hard Day's Night, you know, they're willing to take a chance on Schlesinger because they trust him and they like his work. He hooks up with a New York producer named Jerry Hellman. They decide they're going to film this thing, of course, on the streets of New York. They get together all these incredibly talented people around New York. The casting director, a woman named Marion Doherty, who finds them the best, you know, New York actors to not only Dustin Hoffman and a guy named John Voight, who's never been in a movie, but who they hired to play Joe Buck, tall, blonde guy from Yonkers, New York, but learns a Texas accent and is just terrific in the movie. The supporting cast, people like Sylvia Miles and Barnard Hughes and Brenda Vaccaro, who are all just so wonderful in the movie. The costume designer, you know, we still remember, I don't know if you recall, Rich, but the costumes these guys wore, the cowboy hat and the suede coat,
yes,
and the sticking up in the crowd, designed by a woman named Anne Roth, who incidentally at 89 years old now has been nominated for her fifth Academy Award for Best Costumes for Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. I mean, this is a talented group of people.
My guest today is Glenn Frankel. His latest book is titled Shooting Midnight Cowboy: Art, Sex, Loneliness, Liberation, and the Making of a Dark Classic. He'll have a virtual event at Magic City Books this coming Thursday, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, you mentioned that UA was willing to take a risk on this film. Did they know the risk they were getting into with, you know, what would eventually become an X rating, which a few years later, that will be the kiss of death for any film? I mean, I can only think of a few mainstream films that actually received the X rating. I'm thinking of Midnight Cowboy, Last Tango in Paris, and really, the list goes far and few after those two.
Well, Kubrick's Clockwork Orange was originally rated X also, but
that's
you're right.
Right,
it was rare. The rating system was, as I had suggested earlier, designed to sort of open up movies a bit and allow you to make a film that you couldn't have made 5 years earlier, and perhaps it gets an R or even an X. Only as time goes on, of course, it sort of gets reserved for pornography and people shy away from it. But here's the interesting thing. The film was actually rated R by the ratings board, by the new ratings board. They saw the quality of the movie, and even though it doesn't have nudity in it, but it has some sex scenes that are very uncomfortable, including two gay sex scenes. I mean, remember, John Schlesinger is gay, so is Jim Herlihy, who wrote the novel. They were willing to show, let's say, adult themes and, you know, without pulling their punches. And that made people nervous, and it made the people in charge of United Artists nervous. And so they consulted with a psychiatrist in New York, an eminent psychiatrist. This is back in the days when, you know, homosexuality was looked at as some kind of disease, as an illness that and even in New York, which is a very liberal city, and even among the liberal media in New York, like the New York Times and the New York Review of Books, homosexuality was looked upon as a perversion and as potentially a contagious perversion that would affect young people.
We have to remember,
so the United Artists itself, who eventually decide to rate the movie X because of their anxieties over homosexuality, and it reflects its era in that way. But of course, to everyone's surprise, it goes on to be nominated for and then win Best Picture, the only picture ever to win, X-rated picture ever to win the Academy Award.
It's interesting that the Stonewall riots in New York City happened after the filming had already concluded. So, I mean, we're looking at this sort of, it's a very much a groundbreaking film in that regard.
It is. Well, it's sort of the dawn of the era of gay liberation. Women's liberation is happening in this time. Remember, this is the late 60s. The country's going through what I call the sort of political nervous breakdown. I mean, the Vietnam War was raging. Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King had been assassinated the previous year. Richard Nixon had just been elected president. This is we think of our own turbulent era now, and we're going through one now, no question. But the late 60s was another one. And so these political events, these cultural changes are all happening in this era, and Midnight Cowboy is very much part of the sort of front line of pushing this.
Can you talk about some of the stories surrounding casting of Dustin Hoffman as Ratso Rizzo, John Voight in his first film role as Joe Buck, some of the veteran character actors that show up in the film? What really stood out to you in the course of making the film?
Well, it's interesting. You know, we look at John Voight and Dustin Hoffman in that photo on the cover of my book of the two of them, and they seem so like such a great pair. Voight's 6'3", blonde guy. Dustin Hoffman's 5'6", dark-haired guy. They seem to match up almost like Don Quixote and Sancho Panza. But back in the day, John Schlesinger, the director, really didn't want either of these guys at first. he didn't want a new movie star like Dustin Hoffman messing up his film shoot. He was worried about that. He looked at The Graduate and said, this young guy, this clean-cut young guy, can play Ratso Rizzo. He didn't realize at first Hoffman's skills as a character actor. Hoffman really wants the role, and so he dresses in a dirty raincoat and worn-out shoes and 3 days of growth, you know, without shaving his face. And they meet up around midnight in Times Square, and Schlesinger said by about 4 a.m. in the morning, he had been convinced that this was the right guy, that he fit in so well in Times Square. He didn't want John Voight either. He didn't think he looked the part of you know, the way that the physical characteristics of Joe Buck are sketched out in the novel. But Marion Doherty, the casting director, who, as I suggested earlier, she knew all the best actors on the theater. She knew the right people to plug in. She thought Voight had the right skills and would, you know, would be the right person for this movie. And eventually, they decide to get him, and frankly, partly because he came so cheap. They paid him $17,000 for his part in this movie. But they begin to see that Voight has the dedication and the skills to carry this thing off. And so the two of them are really the key. You're right. There, you know, there are a number of other supporting actors that Marion Doherty finds for them who are really wonderful in capturing New York and all its sort of predatory glory. Sylvia Miles is on the, you know, only has 6 minutes in the movie near the start. She plays an aging hooker, and Joe Buck thinks he's going to hit her up for $20. And in fact, she takes $20 from him for their little tryst together. And she's terrific. And even though she's on for 6 minutes, she was nominated for Best Supporting Actress. So you've got great actors going at it here. But, you know, Rich, I think the real key is Voight and Hoffman. The wary, slowly evolving friendship between Joe Buck and Ratso Rizzo. And these two guys, these two actors, collaborated, they competed with each other, they kind of pushed each other along. I got to interview each of them separately during the course of the researching the book, and the interesting thing was to hear them talk about each other and what an amazing experience it was to work together on this. And that's what you see on the screen, and I think that's also why the movie still endures. Because that central partnership is so interesting and so well done.
It's interesting you mention Don Quixote, because it is that sort of relationship, you know, the Don Quixote, Sancho Panza, Don Giovanni, Leporello, you know, all that sort of an archetype character of, you know, the womanizer and the enabler. Is that a key to the success of the film in your view?
Yeah, I do think so. I think these guys, I can't think of a better pair of male actors in leading roles who are better than these two. These guys are right up there at the top, and I think that makes a huge difference. They did a lot of work in their rehearsals of improvisations with each other that then John Schlesinger and his screenwriter, Waldo Salt, incorporated into the script. So there's an intimacy between them, but the thing is, it's not your usual buddy movie. They don't, you know, they're not pals. You know, they are wary loners,
right,
who are stuck in a situation where winter's coming to New York and they don't have a place to live and they don't have any money. And they come to rely on each other out of desperation. And at first they don't trust each other at all. But gradually over time they begin to recognize, I think, some of the qualities each and the other person and their need. And so they make their way through, and we see this sort of vulnerability that each has and this willingness to begin to, you know, let the other guy in a little bit. These are lonely people, and New York can be a very lonely place, especially when you don't have any money. And so, yes, I think that story, as Jim Herlihy told it in the novel and as Schlesinger and Voight and Hoffman, you know, depicted in the movie, is the key to why that's still a movie you're going to want to see.
I'm glad you mentioned Waldo Salt, because that's another interesting backstory that you share. You know, Waldo Salt, you know, he was blacklisted, and he's coming back in the 1960s, and he writes the screenplay for this.
Yeah, Waldo was a very interesting person to follow. He was a member of the American Communist Party. He gets blacklisted during the Red Scare era in the early 50s. And he gets, you know, after making a good salary in Hollywood, he's a writer's writer. I mean, really wrote for movies, really thought of script writing almost as poetry, and using images much more than words, of course, because that's the medium he was in. But for 10 years, the only work he gets is writing under a false name for some TV shows. And the money dries up. He's also a raging alcoholic. His family, you know, he's got a wife and two daughters, and that gets difficult. His wife has to support the family. Waldo is a mess. And in the mid-60s, of course, the Blacklist is, and the Red Scare is over, but Waldo is in trouble. But John Schlesinger and Jerry Hellman, the producer of Midnight Cowboy, they need a writer who can take that novel and capture its spirit. And Waldo, Waldo's agent, a guy named George Lito, really pushed him hard, and they decided to give Waldo a chance. The early scripts they had hadn't worked anyway, so and Waldo gave him a memo that really seemed to understand what the movie was about, or should be about. And sure enough, he comes through with a really terrific script. He's also there on the set helping out and helping make changes and explaining things all the way through the shoot. He said it was the greatest experience of his career to be working with such a talented company of people. And sure enough, his screenplay gets nominated for Best Adapted Screenplay for an Oscar, and he wins.
Yeah.
And so this is redemption for Waldo in a really big way. He went on to write a number of other screenplays, Serpico with Al Pacino. And he wins another Academy Award in the late 70s for co-writing the screenplay for Coming Home, the Vietnam War movie about Vietnam War veterans. So he's another character who, you know, my book is full of people who I found fascinating, the people who did the music, you know, Harry Nilsson and Fred Neil, the, you know, other folks in this film. I just found them a really interesting crew, and Waldo in many ways was the key.
Well, you mentioned, of course, it did win Best Picture, it won Best Adapted Screenplay, it won Best Director. Was that expected on Academy Award night?
You know, it really wasn't. I mean, this was a little film, cost in the end, well, they went way over budget, so it was up to $3 million. It was made, though, in New York, and Hollywood tends to award its Oscars to films made in Hollywood. An X-rated film, that certainly stretched things. But as I say, you know, the rules were changing, and Hollywood was kind of desperate. Movies that you wouldn't expect suddenly were popular, The Graduate being one of them. Easy Rider came out the same year. I mean, that movie for $400,000 made something like $60 million. All the rules were being broken, and the studios are smart, a lot of smart people in the Hollywood studios, and they could see that they needed to go with the times. Schlesinger was a respected director, so it wasn't that big a surprise in the end that he won. But I would say the Best Picture Oscar was a real surprise, and gave the movie momentum and a boost. And it did not only very well critically, it also made very good money as a result.
Name of the book is Shooting Midnight Cowboy. Glenn, thanks very much for your time.
Well, Rich, it's great to talk to you again. I look forward to I can't come to Tulsa this time because of the pandemic, but I'm looking forward to our Zoom talk on Thursday night and coming back to Tulsa someday. It's such a wonderful, culturally vibrant city.
Glenn Frankel is the author of Shooting Midnight Cowboy, Art, Sex, Loneliness, Liberation, and the Making of a Dark Classic. It's published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. He'll be participating in a Magic City Books virtual event this Thursday evening at 7. Visit magiccitybooks.com. For details. As we leave you with music from the score of Midnight Cowboy by John Barry, I'll remind you that Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. I'm Rich Fisher.